this is Stephen Cohen here with the podcast Quantitative Investigations. This is episode 2, Energy Policy. Welcome, everyone. We're talking here from Colorado Springs, Colorado. And I have with me Goose the Engineer.
Ayo.
Just so everyone knows, Goose the Engineer is not an official part of the show, but every now and then I'll just engage him just to break up the monotony of hearing myself talk, because I generally put myself to sleep listening to myself. So it's good to have another voice.
I am essential.
Yes, you are. So welcome, everyone. This is episode 2, Energy Policy. This episode of Quantitative Investigations piggybacks after episode 1, which was climate change. As we said in episode 1, and we presented the data, climate change is natural. Carbon dioxide cannot control our climate. It is a physical impossibility. However, what we want to discuss today is how anthropogenic climate change has infiltrated into energy policy, and what does it really mean for the general public? Before I start, I really do have to give a shout out to anyone who does broadcasting for a living, any commentator, radio or television, or any podcaster, because what I'm finding out is that it's really difficult to talk to yourself into a microphone for a long period of time and sound coherent.
I will say, this rubbing your hands is gonna get into the microphone.
Really?
Yeah. So I thought it was a good thing to add on the note of podcasting being hard, because fidgeting is also gonna get into the microphone. So you can't rub your knuckles anymore. I'm sorry. I have to ban that.
Okay, so is that part of the podcast, or do we have to start again?
I think that's just part of the podcast. I think it's a candid moment. While we're here, I honestly might as well add, last time I was eating mac and cheese from Noodles & Company, today's episode is going to be sponsored by Wingstop.
Okay, officially, we do not have any sponsors. It's just that Goose has decided he was hungry and he was going to have wings.
These fries are phenomenal.
That's great. That's great. Well, thank you for that interlude. I just violated rule number 1 by saying the word
Disgraceful.
All right. Getting to point number 2. When I made the statements in my first podcast that you need to investigate everyone, I don't want anyone to think that I was preaching. I do live that mantra. In scoping out this podcast, I had some preconceived notions regarding the amount of pollution coming from the transportation sector, and that's how I was going to scope out the first part of this podcast. However, when I went onto the Energy Information Energy's website, that is Goose's favorite website, I realized that I was incorrect. And so really, you need to not only check news sources, social media sources, what people say, you need to check yourself every now and then. Because I would have, if I hadn't, I would have just made statements that I would have had to retract, and I don't like being incorrect. The next thing I'd just like to go over, just a little side note, is lying by omission. Fox News has taken on the policy, this was reported by the New York Times and Newsmax, that Fox News has been banning anything related to Donald Trump. Now, this should concern everyone, not because it's Donald Trump and not because it's Fox News. The players here are irrelevant. It is omission. And this is a very common tactic by media. And it's very effective because we don't know what we don't know. So when someone lies by omission, it is very nefarious. And it's difficult to sometimes figure out what you're not being told. How does this play? In 2020, September 2020, the Hunter Biden laptop story came out. and it was suppressed by Facebook, Twitter, and much of the news media. So a lot of people didn't hear about it. There was a poll done by the Media Research Center, which albeit is a conservative-leaning organization, that stated that 17% of voters would have changed their mind if they knew about the Hunter Biden laptop story. So you really need to ask yourself, is this the way we want to be? Do we really want social media, news media, other nefarious people dictating how we should vote by lying by omission? So we should all think about that. Okay. Anything else I have to cover, Goose, or is that it?
All sounds great from over here.
How are those wings?
They're great. What are these ones? These are honey.
Honey lemon dry rub.
Butterscotch. I don't know. They're good. I'll keep eating them.
That's great. Thank you for that interlude, Goose, who has no idea what's on his wings. So, air pollution. So we're moving from carbon dioxide to air pollution. Why am I doing this? Because while anthropogenic climate change based on quote-unquote greenhouse gases is not true, generic air pollution issues are true. And we know this if we live in cities that have smog warning days, ozone action days. And so this all plays into energy policy. Just for everyone's edification, the primary pollutants that are controlled by the federal government, and in this case, it would be EPA under the Clean Air Act, which, by the way, is one of the earliest environmental regulations. It's pre-EPA. There are seven pollutants: carbon monoxide, nitrogen dioxide, sulfur dioxide, ozone, particulates smaller than 10 microns, which otherwise is known as PM10, and particulates smaller than 2.5 microns, which is also known as PM2.5. That was six pollutants, and that's because I don't know how to count. So, I heard anecdotal evidence that during COVID, cities that would have smog, were seeing improvements in their air quality because of people not driving. So I kind of investigated this just because that's kind of what I do. And what I did was I downloaded a chart of ozone air pollution from Los Angeles County. And what's interesting, so these reports were coming in COVID, which started at the end of 2019, beginning of 2020, was in full throes by about March of 2020. Ozone contamination in Los Angeles County was actually higher than in 2019. Ozone is one of the primary components of smog. When you look out over a city and you see an orange tinge to the air, that is generally ground level ozone, which forms from volatile organic compounds and heat added with a little humidity. That's generally how ground level ozone is formed. It's a respiratory irritant. I would have expected to see a decrease from 2019 to 2020 if air pollution had actually improved during COVID. Unfortunately, the numbers aren't out for 2021. So I really have no idea why this would have happened, except for the fact that smog may not be primarily caused by ozone, which would be pretty interesting. So moving along from that aside, let's go to energy, the main topic of this episode. There are various forms of energy. we have quote unquote renewables. And I say quote unquote because there really is no such thing as renewable energy. There's no such thing as green energy. All forms of utility generation have their issues. So under renewables, you'd have solar and wind. You have nuclear. You have oil. You have coal, geothermal. There are a number of different types of energy generation. What's happening, of course, now is because the federal government and many other governments are using anthropogenic climate change to push energy policy. There is a push to actually move away from certain forms of energy to go to wind and solar because they are quote unquote clean. They don't produce any emissions. Meanwhile, you have the other pollution problems, which we'll probably end up discussing later. The big question is, why are we going down that road? And of course, we discussed the anthropogenic climate change, but let's actually take a look at what is happening with carbon dioxide emissions in the United States and also globally. It's pretty interesting. So in the United States, our carbon dioxide emissions, total carbon dioxide emissions, and there are a number of different sectors. The main sectors are commercial, industrial, transportation, and electric power. And by the way, I'm getting this carbon dioxide emissions data from the Energy Information Agency. And the website is EIA.gov. What this data shows, actually since 2007, carbon dioxide emissions have been decreasing and have been decreasing fairly steadily. Interestingly, the data shows the COVID crash from 2019 to 2020. There is a definite crash in CO2 emissions. That's obviously from the shutdown of the economy at that time. In 2021, even though some of the shutdown was still in place, we saw a rebound of carbon dioxide emissions. However, still nothing near 2007. So carbon dioxide emissions have been decreasing since 2007 in the United States. Well, what's been happening globally? So there is an agency called the International Energy Agency, the IEA. And they track carbon dioxide emissions globally, which I imagine is an enormous task. What they show is that from 2017, there was global CO2 emissions have been decreasing. There was definitely a crash at around 2020, obviously, which is the COVID crash. And then there was a slight recovery in 2021. I don't have 2022 because that data doesn't exist yet. However, global CO2 emissions have been decreasing since 2017. Now, here's the kicker. What have carbon dioxide concentrations been doing since 2018? Well, they've been increasing at the same slope that they've been increasing according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, on the same slope since 1960. Goose, what do you think that means?
If they've been increasing steadily since 1960, I would imagine that nothing recently has affected how they've been increasing.
Said a different way, very good. Said differently. It's if it is as the experts say, and NASA actually has a quote on their website that human activity has been responsible for a 50% increase in carbon dioxide concentrations starting from the second half of the 20th century. If that is the case, and global carbon dioxide emissions have been actually decreasing, albeit slightly if you plot it out, and there's no change in the slope of carbon dioxide, atmospheric carbon dioxide concentrations as collected by NOAA, that is a clear indication that there's another source of carbon dioxide. What is that source of carbon dioxide, Goose?
Cows. No, it's methane. My bad. carbon cows.
The answer is, I don't really know off the top of my head. I can conjecture, which I don't usually do on this podcast, so I'm not going to conjecture here unless I have my conjecture alarm, which I didn't set up my conjecture alarm.
Conjecture alert. Okay. Burr, 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 burr. Wee woo. Wee woo. Conjecture. Conjecture.
The conjecture is that the oceans contain a large amount of carbon dioxide, and one of the properties of water, as water heats up, it can absorb less gases. Said a different way, cold water can hold and absorb higher concentrations of gases like oxygen and CO2 than warm water. So it is very possible, and this is conjecture, it is very possible that ocean off-gassing actually has been contributing to atmospheric carbon dioxide. But if human beings are causing increases in atmospheric carbon dioxide, but yet globally for 4 years, we have no increase and a slight decrease in carbon dioxide, it should have been reflected in NOAA's data. It is not. That says something. However, carbon dioxide still appears to be the main push that's driving energy policy. So, getting to analyzing forms of energy and analyzing forms, comparing different forms of energy is not easy. And I know some of the topics that I'm going to address today will not be easily understood. I apologize for that, but I will do my best. There are three criteria when comparing various forms of energy. Number one is energy density. Number two is capacity factor. And number three is cost. And the easiest one to actually explain is capacity factor, which is why I'm not going to start with that. Let's take a look at what energy density is. Energy density is the energy of a form of electrical generation per unit volume or unit area. And different forms of energy are looked at differently when it comes to energy density. For example, wind and solar, they will usually discuss energy density as energy per unit area because these are wide dispersive facilities. Whereas coal, petroleum, nuclear, they will generally discuss energy density in terms of energy per unit volume. However, it's really difficult. It's way too difficult to compare energy densities of, say, wind and solar versus nuclear and coal if you're not talking about energy density in the same units. And by the way, I should preface this conversation that I am in the nuclear energy business and in the uranium mining business. So everyone can take that bias that I may have or may express unconsciously or subconsciously. Can you express something unconsciously?
He's knocked out. Get a medic.
Like I told you, I was just putting myself to sleep. There's actually a great paper that I found by a gentleman named Bradley E. Layton. He is in the Department of Mechanical Engineering and Mechanics at Drexel University. And what he did was he developed algorithms to to develop energy densities and put all energy forms in terms of units of energy per unit volume. So that really makes comparison a whole lot easier. Now, why is energy density important? Energy density is important because it determines how large a facility has to be. For example, if you need to get 1,000 kilowatt hours out of utility, well, if you have a form of energy that has an energy density of 45 billion kilowatt hours per cubic meter, then that'll be a smaller facility than one that only has a energy density of 1,000 kilowatt hours per cubic meter. That's where energy density comes in. It plays into the size of the utility. Now, the bigger the utility you need, that's going to have an effect on cost. So, looking at various forms of energy, I've done a comparison based on Mr. Layton's paper. And his paper was published, by the way, in the International Journal of Green Energy. So, just so everyone knows. And here I'm comparing nuclear, oil, coal, natural gas, wind, geothermal, and solar. Out of these forms of energy, solar has by far the lowest energy density, and it is 1.5 times 10 to the minus 6, or 0.0000015 joules per cubic meter, or input in kilowatt hours per cubic meter, it's going to be 4.2 times 10 to the minus 13th. You're talking a really small energy density for solar. On the opposite end, you have nuclear energy. Nuclear energy's energy density is astronomical. It's, I think it's 15 quadrillion, maybe, or 1.5 times 10 to the 15th joules per cubic meter, or it looks like 417 million kilowatt hours per cubic meter. So it's really an astronomical energy density. And everything else falls in between. Oil is about 12,500 kilowatt hours per cubic meter. Coal is 7,500 kilowatt hours per cubic meter. Natural gas is 11.1 kilowatt hours per cubic meter. Wind is quite low, 2 times 10 to the minus 6, or 2 millionths, I guess, of a kilowatt hour per cubic meter. It's probably more than that, probably less than that. 2 times 10 to the minus 6. So you're talking, there is a huge disparity between in energy densities in the various forms of energy. So when you're looking at the calculus of what form of energy you should use, or utilities should use for electrical generation, this should be one of the things that are considered. By the way, the federal government knows it has all these numbers. So that's energy density. How is that for clarity, Goose?
As clear as the glass that I'm looking at you through. Super clear.
Why don't I believe you?
If the average listener plays this back at 0.5 speed, they might understand.
What I would say, and I just did the thing again. What I would say is try and find that paper. it's called A Comparison of Energy Densities of Prevalent Energy Sources in Units of Joules per Cubic Meter. And again, it's in the International Journal of Green Energy. And I actually had a hard time finding this. I would have thought that the Energy Information Agency would have had these numbers, but they don't. So Moving on, capacity factor. Capacity factor is one of my favorites. Capacity factor is the percentage of time that a utility, or in this case, an electrical generation technology operates at full capacity. But let's look at it on a utility level. Let's say, for example, a nuclear power plant is designed for 1,000 megawatts. A capacity factor is the percentage of time that specific plant is operating at the full design capacity. That's what capacity factor is. And what the Energy Information Agency does, it collects data from the various utilities, compiles it into a couple of really neat tables. And we love neat tables, don't we? Yes, we do. So, what the Energy Information Agency did, they looked at non-fossil fuel and fossil fuel forms of generation. We have geothermal, hydroelectric, nuclear. They also looked at biomass and other types of gases. I'm not even going to consider those right now. They're really not very common forms of electrical generation. Solar, wind, and wood. I don't know what utilities are burning wood for electricity, but apparently it happens. On the fossil fuel side, you'll have coal, natural gas, and petroleum. So, how does this all line up and why does this matter? Like energy density, capacity factor plays a role in how large of a utility you are going to need. If you need 1,000 megawatts of electricity out of your utility and you have a capacity factor for that particular form of energy, which is 30%, you are going to need to oversize that utility, or else you are not going to get at a reliable rate the designed capacity of that utility. This is very important. Very important. So what are the capacity factors? Well, I'm looking at for 2021, the winner, which I'm sure some of you are going to be surprised, out of all the energy forms, is nuclear. Nuclear energy has a capacity factor of 92.7%. That means that 92.7% of 2021, the nuclear power plants are operating at full capacity. This is actually an amazing capacity factor, but that is typical for nuclear energy. Geothermal comes in next at 71%. And it's really interesting. I wasn't really expecting that. But geothermal is always there, right? You have the earth, you have heat that emanates from the core of the earth, and it rises up through the core into the mantle and into the crust, and that heat can be tapped. So it's always on. So 71%, that is also a good capacity factor. Let's go to solar. Solar, out of probably the more common energy generators, is the worst. And in solar, you have photovoltaic, which is electric, and you have solar thermal, which is heat. Solar photovoltaic, 24.6% capacity factor. Think about what that means. If you want to develop a solar farm for utility-sized generation, you are then going to have to oversize that utility to account for a 24.6% capacity factor. That is pretty significant. Solar thermal, I think I said, is 20.5%. So that's even worse. But solar thermal isn't really as common as solar photovoltaic. Wind energy, 34.6%. Again, very low capacity factor. Going to the fossil fuels, the highest fossil fuel utility generation is natural gas at 54.4%. That is, well, compared to nuclear, that's pretty low. However, it's, I think it's probably where a lot of utilities need to be at the 50, over 50%. Coal is at 49.3%. Let's go to petroleum. And petroleum is, for some reason, is really low. 16, the steam turbine petroleum is 16.4%. So we've now gone through two criteria, energy density and capacity factor. You're starting to see where some of these fall out. When you look at wind and solar, you look at the extraordinarily low energy densities. You also look at the low capacity factors. You are talking about now having to oversize and take up significant amounts of land to get a utility-sized electrical generation facility. Let me give you an example. About, I don't know, 8 years ago, I did a calculation. I looked at the Arkansas Nuclear One power plant, 1,800 megawatts, and I said to myself, well, what would it take to build a wind farm? How size of a wind farm would you need to get 1,800 megawatts? And so I looked at using the 3.5 megawatt wind turbines, about, I think it was about 120-foot blade length. At that particular time, the spacing guidance between wind turbines is 15 times blade length. And then I looked at a capacity factor of 30%. The answer I got to build an 1,800 megawatt wind farm was 260 square miles. That is the area that you would need. At that time, I was living in Howard County, Maryland. Howard County, Maryland is approximately 254 square miles in area. So you would need to build a wind farm the size of the entire county that I lived in order to get an 1,800 megawatt electrical generating utility equivalent to Arkansas Nuclear One, which takes up about 1.5 square miles. That's how this plays out, ladies and gentlemen. Very important. Very important. Now, going to cost. And I'll have to tell you, looking at costs is not very easy. It's some of it I found a little confusing. I found a table that I think basically explains costs, and it's cost per kilowatt. And this, again, is from the Energy Information Agency. And I've been saying it correctly, Goose. It's the Energy Information Administration.
Unbelievable.
You might have to take me out and execute me.
The whole world is gone cattywampus. I can't believe it.
Is that even a word? Cattywampus?
Yeah, have your followers look it up.
You mean all 20?
Yeah. Cattywampus. It's like a Willy Wonka chocolate factory word, but it's a real word. It's in the dictionary. So look it up.
Will do, my friend. Will do. So the latest data from the Energy Information Administration, got it right, looks at, so we have the various forms of energy, but under uranium, they have advanced nuclear. And advanced nuclear, what they consider to be is the Westinghouse AP1000, which, by the way, I just got word a couple of days ago that Georgia Power's Plant Vogtle just got approval to load up Plant Vogtle number 3, AP1000 nuclear reactor with fuel, which is a very big, very big occasion. So, yippee-yay. However, the AP1000, very expensive new reactors, anywhere from 14 to 25 billion for 1,000 megawatts. There's a new small modular reactor that the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission just certified, and the company is called NuScale, and they have a small modular reactor where for 900 megawatts, it would cost around $2.5 to $3 billion. I know this because I used to talk to their main sales engineer and trying to actually get Colorado Springs Utilities to consider small modular reactors. So that data is not even in here. When you take a look at cost data, it becomes pretty interesting. To put up 20 megawatts, 20 megawatts of solar energy, according to the Energy Information Administration, and this is the kind that, well, we'll just say fixed solar panels as opposed to the tracking, is $2,671 per kilowatt. That's for 20 megawatts. Nuclear. For 2,234 megawatts, that is two AP1000 nuclear reactors, 5,945 kilowatts. So what you would need to do is you need to break out your calculator, unless you're a math genius, and you'd have to divide 2,234 megawatts of advanced nuclear by 20 megawatts of fixed photovoltaic, and that it would be 111 20 megawatt solar farms. Multiply that by 2,671, and you start to see that solar is extraordinarily more expensive. I get $298,350 per kilowatt when you look at the 20 megawatt capacity solar farms. It's not even close, ladies and gentlemen. It's not even close. Let's take a look at onshore wind. Onshore wind is $1,877 per kilowatt for 100 megawatts. Let's go through the same exercise, shall we? I know you're just eager to, because that is what we do here. So you would need 22 of those bad boys $1,877 per kilowatt. You get $41,294 per kilowatt. So what are we doing here? What we're doing is, and what we're analyzing, is the result of politics into highly technical areas of energy generation. We have forms of energy that have low energy densities, low capacity factors, that when you look at megawatt per megawatt are significantly more expensive than, say, nuclear. Yet these are being promoted. It's bad policy. And again, when you consider the capacity factor and the land required, you'll start to understand why you can search on the internet and find articles of rolling brownouts and stresses on our grid by having too high of a percentage of total electrical generation in wind and solar. They are substandard forms of utility generation. Now, I want to make something clear. You need to make something very clear. Putting solar panels on your house, putting a wind turbine in your yard, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. As a matter of fact, that could be a great way for utilities to supplement their power plant generation. It could be a great way. The problem is they are not scalable to utility generation if you expect to keep your electrical generation steady. they are the worst forms of electrical utility generation. And the numbers show it. The federal government knows this. They know it. But yet it's still being pushed because this is what happens when politics overtakes science. So that ends this episode of Quantitative Investigations. I want to summarize because I received some comments that I just ended my previous podcast without a summary. Would you like a summary, Goose?
I would love nothing more, nothing more than a summary. It's been a beautiful 40 minutes and 46 seconds. I think the viewers need a summary.
Wait, how much time was that?
40 minutes and now 53 seconds.
All right. So that means that my summary needs to take up about at least 10 minutes, right?
Give or take. Give or take 10 minutes, actually.
Okay. To appease the critics of my first podcast, first episode, we're going to come up with a summary. So what we have learned today, again, there are three criteria for studying various or comparing various forms of energy. Energy density, capacity factor, cost. When you look at energy density, on the one end, the high end, nuclear power energy density is far superior to anything else. That's not just my bias, that is the fact. And wind and solar are going to be the lowest. And actually, solar has a far lower energy density than wind. When you look at capacity factor, wind and solar have the lowest capacity factors, nuclear has the highest. And when you look at cost, wind and solar will cost more than even the large Westinghouse AP1000, large 1,000 megawatt nuclear reactors. Two of them, though. Not even just one of them, two of them. Now, at this point, some people are saying, yeah, I'm just a cheerleader for nuclear. I have no problem with any form of generation that makes sense. I don't have a problem with coal plants. I don't have a problem with nuclear power plants. As long as it makes sense. I mean, I think I said nuclear power plants. I don't have a problem with coal, natural gas, petroleum. I don't have a problem with any of these other forms of energy. Because even with capacity factors of around 50%, it could still provide, you could still size your power plants to provide the surge that you need in times of stress, like when it's very cold or when it's very hot. Solar and wind do not have that ability. When it's summertime in Texas and it's 104 degrees and the wind is not blowing, what are people going to do? It's a very serious problem and it's a human caused problem. It's malfeasance on the form of people who are making these energy generation decisions. So that's the episode. And again, I do apologize if I come off being a cheerleader for nuclear energy. But again, I give you the information. I tell you where to find it. You can go check the numbers yourself. That is what this podcast is about. This podcast is not about convincing people of my side. This podcast is about educating people where to find the information so you don't have to trust me. You can go look for yourself. And the more you look, the more time you spend investigating issues, the easier it will be to find the information for the most part. So with that, I'd like to thank everyone for listening. I'd like to thank Goose the Engineer for his help today.
Round of applause for myself.
And with that, I bid you a fond adieu.